Santan stood before the heavy mirror in its walnut and gilt frame, and she looked at her reflection with dark and serious eyes. "Tomorrow I will be Madame Michael Courtney," she said solemnly. "Never again Santan de Thierry. Isn't that a formidable thought, Anna?" She touched her own temples. "Do you think I will feel different? Surely such a momentous event must alter me. I can never be the same person after that."
"Wake up, child," Anna prodded her. "There is still so much to do. There is no time for dreaming."
She lifted the bulky skirt and dropped it over Santan's head. Then, standing behind her, she fastened the waistband. "I wonder if Mama is watching, Anna. I wonder if she knows I am wearing her dress, and if she is happy for me." Anna grunted as she went down on her knees to check the hem. Santan smoothed the delicate old lace over her hips and listened to the muffled sound of men's laughter from the grand salon on the floor below. "I am so happy that the general could come. Isn't he a handsome man, Anna, just like Michel? Those eyes, did you notice them?"
Again Anna grunted, but with more emphasis. For a moment her hands faltered as she thought about the general. "Now that is a real man," she told herself, as she watched Sean Courtney step down from the rolls and come up the front staircase of the chateau.
"He looks so grand in his uniform and medals," Santan went on. "When Michel is older, I will insist that he grows a beard like that. So much presence."
There was another burst of laughter from below.
"He and Papa like each other, don't you think, Anna? Listen to them."
"I hope they leave some cognac for the other guests," Anna grumped, and hoisted herself to her feet, then paused with one hand on the small of her back as a thought struck her. "We should have laid out the blue Dresden service rather than the Sèvres. It would have looked better with the pink roses."
"You should have thought of that yesterday," Santan cut in quickly. "I am not going to go over all that again."
The two of them had worked all the previous day and most of the night to reopen the Grand Salon, which had been closed ever since the servants left. The draperies had been floury with dust, and the high ceilings so laced with cobwebs that the scenes from mythology that decorated them were almost obscured. They had finished the cleaning red-eyed and sneezing before beginning on the silver, which had been all tarnished and spotted. Then each piece of the red and gold Sèvres dinner service had to be washed and hand-dried. The Comte protesting volubly, "A veteran of Sedan and the army of the Third Empire forced to labour like a common varlet," had been dragooned in to assist. Finally, it had all been done. The salon once again splendid, the floor of intricately fitted and painted wooden blocks glossy with wax, the nymphs and goddesses and fauns dancing and cavorting and chasing each other across the domed ceiling, the silver aglitter and the first of Anna's cherished roses from the greenhouse glowing like great gems in the candlelight.
"We should have made a few more pies," Anna worried. "Those soldiers have appetites like horses."
"They are not soldiers. They are airmen," Santan corrected her. "And we have enough to feed the entire Allied army, not merely a single squadron." Santan broke off. "Listen, Anna."
Anna waddled to the window and looked out.
"It is them," she declared. "So early?"
The drab brown truck came puttering up the long gravel drive, looking prim and old-maidish on its high, narrow wheels, the back crowded with all the off-duty officers from the squadron, the adjutant at the wheel with his pipe clamped in his jaws, and a fixed and terrified expression on his face as he steered the vehicle on an uneven course from one verge of the wide driveway to the other, loudly encouraged by his passengers.
"Have you locked the pantry?" Anna demanded anxiously. "If that tribe find the food before we are ready to serve..."
Anna had enlisted her cronies from the village, those who had not fled the war, and the pantry was an Aladdin's cave of cold pies and pâtés, and the wonderful local terrines of hams and apple tarts,
of pig's trotters with truffles in aspic and a dozen other delights.
"It's not the food they have come for so early in the day," Santan joined her at the window. "Papa has the keys to the cellar. They will be well taken care of."
Her father was already halfway down the marble staircase to greet them, and the adjutant braked with such abruptness that two of his pilots landed in the front seat with him in a tangle of legs and arms.
"I say," he cried in obvious relief at being once again at a standstill, "you must be the jolly old count, what? We are the advanced guard. How do you say it in French? Le d'avant-garde. Don't you know?"
"Ah, to be sure," the comte seized his hand. "Our brave allies, you are welcome, welcome. May I offer you a small glass of something?"
"You see, Anna," Santan smiled as she turned back from the window, "there is no need to worry. They understand each other. Your food will be safe from them, for a while at least."
She picked up the wedding veil from the bed and arranged it loosely over her head, and studied herself in the mirror.
"This must be the happiest day of my life," she whispered. "Nothing must happen to spoil it."
"Nothing will, my child."
Anna came up behind her and arranged the filmy lace of the veil upon her shoulders.
"You will be the loveliest bride. What a pity that none of the gentry will be here to see you." "Enough, Anna," Santan told her gently. "No regrets. Everything is perfect. I would not have it any other way."
She cocked her head slightly. "Anna?" Her expression became animated.
"What is it?"
"Do you hear?"
Santan spun away from the mirror.
"It's him. It's Michel. He's coming back to me."
She ran to the window, and unable to contain herself, she hopped up and down, dancing like a little girl at the window of a toy shop.
"Listen, he's coming this way."
She could recognize the distinctive beat of the engine that she had so often listened for.
"I don't see him."
Anna was behind her, screwing up her eyes, looking upwards in the ragged clouds.
"He must be very low," Santan began. "Yes, yes, there he is, just above the forest."
"I see him. Is he going to the airfield in the orchard?"
"No, not with this wind. I think he's coming this way."
"Is it him? Are you sure?"
"Of course I'm sure. Can't you see the color? Mon petit jaune."
Others had heard it also. There were voices below the window, and a dozen of the wedding guests trooped out through the fresh doors of the salon onto the terrace. They were led by Sean Courtney in the full dress uniform of a British general, and the comte even more resplendent in the blue and gold of a colonel of the infantry of Napoleon III. They all carried their glasses, and their voices were raised in mounting spirits and cheerful camaraderie.
"That's Michael, all right," someone called. "I'll bet he's going to give us a low-level beat-up. Take the roof off the chateau, you'll see. It should be a victory roll, considering what he's got in store."
Santan found herself laughing with them, and she clapped her hands as she watched the yellow machine approaching. Then her hands froze an instant before they came together.
"Anna," she said, "there is something wrong."
The aircraft was close enough now for them to see how irregularly it was flying. One wing dropped, and the machine yawed and dipped towards the treetops, then pulled up sharply, and its wings wobbled, and then it dropped on the opposite side.
"What's he up to?"
The timbre of the voices from the terraces changed.
"By God, he's in trouble. I think..."
The SE-5A began a meandering, purposeless turn to starboard, and they could see the side of the damaged fuselage and the torn wing surfaces as it banked. It looked like the carcass of a fish that had been attacked by a pack of sharks.
"He's been badly shot up," one of the pilots yelled. "Yes, he's hard hit."
The SE-5A turned back too steeply. The nose dropped and almost hit the trees.
"He's going to try for a forced landing."
Some of the pilots jumped over the wall of the terrace and ran out onto the lawns, frantically signalling to the crippled aircraft.
"This way, Michael! Keep the nose up, man!" "Too slow!" screamed another. "You'll stall her in! Open the throttle! Give her the gun!
They shouted their futile advice, and the aircraft settled heavily towards the open lawns.
Michel!
Santaine breathed, twisting the lace between her fingers and not even feeling it tear.
Come to me, Michel!
There was one last row of trees, ancient copper beech, with the new leaf buds on their gnarled branches just beginning to pop open. They guarded the bottom of the lawns, furthest from the chateau. The yellow SE-5A dropped behind them, the beat of her engine faltering.
Get her up, Michael! Pull her up, damn it!
They were shouting to him, and Santaine added her own entreaty.
Please, Michel, fly over the trees. Come to me, my darling.
The Viper engine roared again at full power, and they saw the machine rocket up like a great yellow pheasant rising from cover.
He's going to make it!
The nose was too high. They all saw it. She seemed to hover above the stark, leafless branches, and they reached up like the claws of a monster. Then the yellow nose dropped.
He's over!
One of the pilots exulted. But one of the landing wheels caught on a heavy, curved branch, and the SE-5A somersaulted in mid-air, then fell out of the sky. It hit the soft earth at the edge of the lawn, landing on its nose, the spinning propeller exploding in a blur of white splinters, and then, with the wooden frames of the fuselage crackling, the entire machine collapsed, crushed like a butterfly, its bright yellow wings folding around the crumpled body. And Santaine saw Michael. He was daubed with his own blood. It had streaked his face. His head was thrown back, and it was hanging halfway out of the open cockpit, dangling in his straps like a man on the gallows. Michael's brother officers were streaming down the lawn. She saw the general throw his glass aside and hurl himself over the terrace wall. He ran, with a desperate, uneven gait, the limp throwing him off balance, but he was gaining on the younger men. The first of them had almost reached the wrecked aircraft when the flames engulfed it with miraculous suddenness. They shot upwards with a drumming, roaring sound, very pale-coloured but plumed with black smoke at their crests. And the running men stopped and hesitated and then drew back, holding up their hands to protect their faces from the heat. Sean Courtney charged through them, going straight into the flames, oblivious of the searing, dancing waves of heat, but four of the young officers leapt forward and seized his arms and his shoulders and pulled him back. Sean was struggling in their grip so wildly the three others had to run up and help to restrain him. Sean was roaring, a deep, throaty, incoherent sound, like a bull buffalo in a trap, trying to reach out through the flames to the man trapped in the crumpled body of the yellow aircraft. Then, quite suddenly, the sound ceased, and he sagged. If the men had not been holding him, he would have fallen to his knees. His hands dropped to his sides, but he went on staring into the wall of flame. Years before, on a visit to England, Santaine had watched with horrid fascination as the children of her host had burnt the effigy of an English assassin called Guy Fawkes on a pyre that they had built themselves in the garden. The effigy had been cleverly fashioned, and as the flames rose up over it, it had blackened and begun to twist and writhe in a most lifelike fashion. Santaine had woken in the sweat of nightmare 4 weeks afterwards. Now, as she watched from the upper window of the chateau, she heard somebody near her begin to scream. She thought that it must be Anna. There were cries of the utmost anguish, and she found herself shaking to them the way a sapling shakes to the high wind. It was the same nightmare as before. She could not look away as the effigy turned black and began to shrivel, its limbs spasming and jackknifing slowly in the heat. And the screams filled her head and deafened her. Only then did she realize that it was not Anna, but that the screams were her own. As these gusts of agonized sound came up from the depths of her chest, they seemed to be of some abrasive substance, like particles of crushed glass that ripped at the lining of her throat. She felt Anna's strong arms around her, lifting her off her feet, carrying her away from the window. She fought with all her strength, but Anna was too powerful for her. She laid Santan on the bed and held her face to her vast, soft bosom, stifling those wild screams. When at last she was quiet, she stroked her hair and began to rock her gently, humming to her as she used to do when Santan was an infant.